Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Hey, Murph.
Hey.
What comes after 129?
130. Look at me. That's West Virginia math right there.
You are. It is episode 130 of Game of Crimes. Welcome, 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 amigos, amigas, players, spirits, dudettes, everybody in between. Welcome back to the 130th attempt to keep us off the air. We shall not climb the interwebs, into the universe.
Well, you know, not only is there 130 episodes, but we've had several bonus episodes, and then we've put some episodes out during the Christmas time that we don't even count in our number. So it's well above 130.
206. If you think of episodes 1 and 2, we have 266 separate segments right now.
That's good stuff.
Yeah, baby. I mean,
the heroes we bring on here, they just keep you motivated.
They just keep getting better and better. Well, hey guys, welcome back to Game of Crimes. It's me, Morgan, with my partner in crime.
Hey everybody, it's Murph. Welcome back.
Murph. Hey guys, some quick housekeeping before we get started. Head on over to Apple and Spotify. Hit those 5 stars. Helps us out a lot. Also on Spotify, you can leave comments on each episode. So we've gotten comments on that. Appreciate that. One of them, I won't say which episode it was, but somebody said, "Is this person drunk?" It was a special bonus episode.
Really?
It was an author episode. So.
Okay. Gotcha.
You know which one I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, but hey, we do read them and we appreciate them. So head on over, hit those 5 stars, Apple, Spotify. Also head on over to our website, gameofcrimespodcast.com. Everything's there, including our books, pictures. Like go check out Boyd Holbrook's episode and check out all the neat pictures we put there. Also follow us on that thing they call social media, at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. But I'm telling you, we just got through recording before we did our intro outro. You can't make this shit up. And let me tell you, when you start talking about the crazy places you find weapons, you cannot make
this. You might have to clean that shit off of it, but
yeah. We don't want to give too much away because we don't want to rob you of the satisfaction. When you go over to patreon.com/gameofcrimes and see what kind of fun we have there. We've got 911, what's your emergency? We've got You Can't Make This Shit Up, Case of the Month, the Narcometer Review, our monthly bonus video. And our Q&A, we always love doing our Q&A with our folks. So, you know, you ask, we answer, ask us anything. Mm-hmm. So that's always fun, but you will not find it unless you go to patreon.com/gameofcrimes and let the fun begin. 3 levels, evil is coming, guardian of the realm, and warden of the throne. You know, find the level that works for you, but just join us and hear all the fun and just super fun. I mean, it's not just fun, it's super fun that we're having.
Absolutely. And we get a little more opinionated over there than we do on the regular podcast. So
yeah, we try and play it a little bit more down the middle here. But over there, Murph tends to go off the rails, man. I got to reel him back.
When we record those, I get my soapbox out and I put it right here next to the table so I can get up there on it.
Yeah. But another place you got to visit, go to Facebook, go to type in Game of Crimes fans. Our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato, the Iron Fist with the Velvet Glove, rules overall. Find a way, just join us, folks. We've got a lot of people that are involved, and it's a more intimate group than our big public group. We have lots of fun, share lots of memes, share lots of stories. We get a lot of our guest ideas from there as well. Some of our stories that make it on Small Town Police Blotter. You guys help us out. Go to Game of Crimes fans. Just type it in there. Answer a couple easy questions, and the Iron Queen with the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove will allow you admittance if you are worthy. Right, Murph? Worthy. Got to be worthy.
Hey, if I made it, I'm sure you'll make it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, but you had to bribe her too, though. You had to. There was cash involved and alcohol, I believe.
Don't tick off the queen.
Don't tick off the queen. Hey, by the way, Murph.
That's right.
But you know what? We can't do a show like this unless we tell people what the show is about. And this is a show about crime. We talk about bad people doing bad things and bad people doing bad things to good people. We take the story seriously, but
You know we're not going to take ourselves serious because we're going to have some fun on here.
That is right. And one of the ways we have fun is we dedicate a special time in our episode to talk about funny things that happen. So, Murph, I ask you, guess what time it is?
It is time for Small Town Police Slaughter.
I have that Wild Wild West theme stuck in my head. I'm going to have to go back and rewatch the episodes of that, man. Artemis Gordon and James West, man.
Oh, they were good. They were good.
All right, Murph, this just happened. Six days ago, in a monumentally moronic scheme. I love the way that they wrote it. A monumentally moronic scheme.
Wow.
Murph, anybody remember the people we used to arrest? You know, you'd have parolees or other folks. They'd have to come in. They'd have to do a UA, urinalysis, you know, take a UA test. You know, you have to drug test them, right? People would try and cheat, right? They would try and cheat. They'd bring in somebody else's urine, you know, tape stuff to their legs, right?
Oh, I heard this one. I think I read this one.
Yeah, it's one thing to submit another human's urine. It's another thing to submit dog urine.
Yeah.
So she was subject to random testing as a stipulation of release related to her December 28th arrest for possession of drug paraphernalia. She has a lengthy rap sheet with numerous cocaine convictions related items. So she was released on her own recognizance following his last month arrest. She had an appointment Thursday to pee in a cup at the county's misdemeanor probation units designed to detect the presence of chemical substances or controlled substances. She was concerned her urine would turn up dirty, with a finding likely to result in a bond revocation and immediate jailing. So she showed up with a fraudulent urine sample. So
from?
Well, normally you're monitored by a probation officer, making it difficult. So when she was confronted about the phony sample, she reportedly admitted that she had collected urine from her aunt's dog, which she intended to provide during testing.
Fido.
My question is how do you collect it? How do you store it? And how do you carry it?
I hadn't even thought about that. Now I can't get that out of my mind. You know, she should now be charged with felonious stupidity.
Buffy, come here, Buffy. Pee into a cup for mommy. All right, but Murph, you're going to love this, though, too. She was arrested at the probation office, charged with, urine testing fraudulent practices. There you go. There's a misdemeanor, you know. And he revoked her prior order freeing her. But last year, you're going to appreciate this. She launched a cleaning service that she incorporated with her boyfriend, an ex-con. Here, Murph, you have a cleaning service that you're allowing people into your house. Her boyfriend is an ex-con whose rap sheet includes conviction for robbery, narcotics possession, disorderly conduct, obstructing police, loitering, and prowling. Isn't that the kind of people you want having in your house cleaning?
Oh, absolutely. I would welcome them with open arms and a 38.
Uh-huh.
Unbelievable. Well, again, felonious stupidity.
Yeah. So, and in honor of our next guest, we're only going to do a couple stories here because we want to get to this. But in honor of our next guest, who, after a long, distinguished law enforcement career, we'll tell you about in a minute, now he is the head of security for one of the largest corporations in the world, Walmart.
He did all right. Murph,
here you go. I got a story for you from Walmart. A Florida man.
Of course it's a Florida guy.
Florida man in Walmart, in the bathroom, called 911 to claim there was a bomb in the store and confessed he did it because he had previously seen TikTok videos showing similar fake threats and he decided to make one himself. However, though, it wasn't his phone. He stole the phone from somebody who had left it behind. He went into the bathroom, made the threat. So after the phone's owner told cops he had left it in the store, they reviewed the surveillance footage, and guess what? They saw him entering the bathroom moments before the 911 call was placed. And so cops quickly identified the suspect as Cody Clements, 28, who lives about 10 miles from Walmart after being read his rights. Clement reportedly copped to seeing the cell phone in the stall and deciding to make a prank 911 call. And this is the danger, people. This is the danger when you take these stupid TikTok challenges and Instagram challenges. He watched people on TikTok making fake bomb threats and decided to do one himself. Now he goes, huh, I realize it was a bad decision. You think?
idiot. Just... Idiot.
But I like the... I finish with this. I like the judge's order. So he was charged with making a false report about planting a bomb or weapon of mass destruction, a second-degree felony, He was released from county jail on $15,000 bond and has been ordered by a judge to have no contact with any of the Walmarts. Dude, you've just screwed your entire life. You cannot go shopping at Walmart at maybe ever again. Life is over for you, pal. You just need to move to Ecuador.
They probably got Walmarts there, but he can't go in.
Can't go there. I mean, no.
You can't. You get the same groceries at Walmart that you get in these higher priced dollar, you know, stores. I mean, it's a great place to go shop, save money.
We just did that because the snow is coming in. So what do? We made a Walmart run yesterday. In between the first time I shoveled the driveway and it was supposed to say clear before the snow started coming in at 2:30 this morning, and Murph, we are recording this at 4:30 in the afternoon, and the snow is still coming down.
Yeah, baby. Yeah, our former next door neighbor sent us pictures of our old house there in Virginia earlier today, and I got to say, I just do not miss that snow at all.
Hey, did you have a snowblower? Did you take one with you?
No, my neighbor across the street and I, we bought one that time we had the 3 feet of snow. Remember that several years ago? So he and I went together and bought one. And after that, we never had another major snow. We had a few inches, but never another major snow. So I think you guys are past due.
That's what she said. Thank you very much. had a few inches. Never mind. Sorry. It's just one. I've been out shoveling snow for too long. By the way, I got to give props to my neighbor. I don't want to use his name without his permission, but my neighbor. So I'm out there and the snow is kind of heavy, but he's got this new, it's not a big snow blower, but it's a battery powered shovel. So, but it shoots it in one direction, but Murphy, it is pretty cool. It's battery powered. You take it, you hit the handle and it's got a blade. So I'm shooting snow like 10, 15 feet into my yard. And I'm like, cool. Hey, this is kind of fun. It saved me a little time, but more importantly, it saved me the back strain, so I didn't have to, bend over and throw and lift and pull a muscle.
Absolutely. So. Yeah, because you get ice, and when the water freezes in there, that stuff gets really heavy.
Oh. You wouldn't know, you traitorous bastard. You moved to Florida. You can't even spell snow anymore.
Just so you know, I walked on the beach today.
Yeah, okay. I walked too on the driveway on the ice and the snow. Anyway, let's get into our case in chief. So this was a fun one too, because this is another former DEA guy, but he kind of had a good little history getting into DEA, and he's got one of the most interesting cases we've talked about.
This is the guy. I met him when I was I'd come back from Columbia, stationed in North Carolina, Greensboro, and was working a case, and the source of supply was located in Orlando. Our guest today, Matt Barden, was an Orlando police officer, and he became a narcotics investigator assigned to the DEA task force. That's how I met him. We worked the case successfully. Lo and behold, he joins DEA, works his way all the way up to the senior executive service, which is the special agent in charge, and an opportunity comes along. And you're even going to hear today, he was in headquarters when we brought Boyd and Boyd Holbrook and Pedro Pascal to the DEA Academy. So he was very active in that. You're going to hear all the stories. One of my best friends. I love this guy to death. So let's get him on, because he's got some great stories. And we're excited for you guys to hear what he's doing in life after DEA.
And which is very interesting, too. But I'm telling you, I did this. This story was... Anyway, the title will tell it all. If I don't want to give it away on this, but the title will tell it all. So, Murph, we can't hear about what the story might be unless I ask you. The penultimate, the ultimate, the top of the, you know, heap question, the
apex,
most important one of all. Are you ready to play the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the game of crimes?
Absolutely. So everybody get in, sit down, shut up, and hold on. I've been practicing this since last time. I'm really excited for you to hear my really close friend, Matt Barden.
Well, you know, in advance of Christmas, we thought I'd team up with our next guest and bust Murphy's balls. So we've been doing that for the last couple minutes here, but we thought we should memorialize it and put it on air. Don't you think, Murph? Don't you think it's time we just really bring you back down?
I got big shoulders. I can take you two guys anytime. I'm looking at the picture you're talking about. I'm smiling in that picture. What are you talking about? The goofy looking one was Morgan. And so for our listeners, what we're talking about, our guest today is looking at our Game of Crimes website, looking at our pictures at the bottom of the homepage. And that was taken by a guy over in Sweden, I believe. He sent it to us. I thought I looked rather cute.
I don't know about that.
What?
What'd you say?
I don't know
what'd
about you say that.
Well, you can introduce us to our guests, or are we just going to sit here and let everybody guess? Is this our new Game of Crimes? You know, whose line is it? You know, who's the mystery?
We're going to make this a Patreon channel game where guess who we have with us today?
Guess who's coming to dinner?
So actually, we have our guest today is he and I have been friends for umpteen years. I met him when he was in Orlando Police Department. And I was a working agent in Greensboro, North Carolina. This is after I'd come back from Columbia.
Well, there's the first lie. I was a working agent.
Well, anyway,
we were investigating by the federal government, is what you were saying. Yeah.
I was working with two investigators in North Carolina. It was Wayne Bridgers from the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation and J.D. Barber from Salisbury Police Department. We got into some Haitian cocaine traffickers that were based out of Orlando. So as the case developed, we had to come down to Orlando, and we were trying to flip some people on a historical conspiracy. So I called the DEA office, and they said, oh, we got just a guy for you to work with. He don't do shit, so we're going to give him something to do. And that was Task Force Officer Matthew Barden. Now, Matt turned out to be, we have turned out to be lifelong friends now. So that was probably, what, 90?
Oh, gosh.
96, well, 97?
So when did you come back from Columbia?
June 94.
So I started a task force in November of 94 and then got hired by DEA in February of 98. So it had to be late 96, 97.
Yeah. And, you know, and based on what you just told us, there's proof that DEA hires the handicapped. So welcome aboard bro.
There's no doubt. It took me 3 years to get hired.
Oh, this is going to be good. Wow. Yeah, after hearing Murph's story. Well, hey, let's rewind as we do with everybody. Matt Barden, Cosa Nostra, thing of ours. How did you get started in this thing of ours we call law enforcement? I'm assuming, you know, you did something wrong. You're sitting in the station one day going, I got to get my, you know, got to turn my life around. Otherwise, I'm going to end up in the pokey. So what happened? What's the real story?
I grew up in Orlando, Florida, and my dad was for a few years an Orlando cop way before I was ever him and my mom ever thought about me. Through just progression of life, I was the first one of eight kids that was afforded the opportunity to go to college. And I went to college and had absolutely no idea that you actually had to go to class to get through it. And I had no resources in my family history to sit there and guide me. And sad part about it, about 6 months after I started college, my dad died when I was 19 years old. And he and I were the best of friends. I was the youngest of eight. And so long and short of it is, I went back to school and I tried to screw it up just about every day that I could. And I was in a fraternity. And
which school were you at and what fraternity?
I was, I went to Western Carolina University in the mountains of, Western North Carolina. And I was, in the Lambda Chi Alpha. And, after my father died, those guys, wrapped their arms around me, and it was truly a great experience for me. Although I had absolutely no idea going into it, even what a fraternity was. So,
anyway, when he passed away, was it medical? Was it on the job injury?
No, my dad was an avid fisherman, and Steve probably has been in Orlando long enough to know where Lake Conway is. And my dad was an avid fisherman, and he went fishing on probably one of the coldest days of that probably still of record in Orlando. It was about 27 degrees as a high, and he was fishing and fell out of the boat, and we had all this heavy winter gear and things like that, and he drowned.
Oh.
So he was missing for 9 days. That was in February of 1984.
And you were how old then?
I was 19 years old. I'd been at Western Carolina since September or August or so of 1983. And he was missing for 9 days. As we all know from the law enforcement business, right? It's cold. a lot of heavy gear. He finally floated up, and Orange County Sheriff's Office recovered his body. That was on a Thursday. I can remember the deputy coming up and knocking on our door. Had his funeral on a Friday. I told my mom that I didn't want to go back to college. I was going to take care of her. And she looked across at my aunt and uncle who lived in Atlanta, and she said, "You take him back tomorrow." And so we found him on Thursday, buried him on Friday, and I was back in Western North Carolina on Saturday.
And when your mom said that, you said, "Yes, ma'am," right?
I did. I did. She says, "Your dad's not even been in the grave long enough to roll over, but he will if you don't go back to school." That was my dad's primary focus at that point in time, that he was going to be sure that I went to college. So, but anyway, so I met, had some fraternity brothers that were in criminal justice and, was really lost at the time, and really resonated with that, bit off on it, and graduated. Best thing I found out of Western was my wife of 36 years. So not long after graduation, I went back to Orlando, swore up and down that I had never wanted to work for the Orlando Police Department because they were, they chased me and gave me tickets and did all those things in my youth. And that was the one agency I wasn't going to work for.
And let me ask you something. Did you do any of those things by accident? I mean, like run from the cops or get tickets, or do you think you might have deserved maybe a couple of those?
Oh, I'm pretty sure I deserved a lot more than I got. So,
hey, but wait, before you go too much further, so what did you major in college?
Criminal justice.
Okay. Then do you still have to pay your wife annually to stay with you? Or?
Yeah, trust me, brother. Trust me. You know the story about that. I tried to screw it up every day, and she saved me from myself.
We all married up.
Yeah, there's no doubt. There's no doubt.
36 years for me too. You know, and I told somebody one time, I said, "Look, I'm really lucky because she could have whacked me and been out of prison in 10 years with good behavior and been, 26 years ahead." So,
there's no doubt. There's no doubt. So anyways, I came back, and of course, like, so many others that you've had on your podcast that have gone into federal law enforcement, I put in coming out of college thinking I'm the person they're all looking for. And I put in every agency that there was out there. And of course you get the letter to come back and says, "Hey, when you get 3 years experience, give us a call."
Now, and, did you only apply federally, or did you apply locally as well too during that time?
No, I was a college graduate. I deserved a federal job.
Gotcha.
Right. I mean, that's what you think when you come out of college, right? I mean, I'm going to be scooped up.
It's not only that I deserve it. They deserve me. I am that good.
Yeah. So, it was a real, settling experience. And so then I readjusted my goals and started applying for, Orlando Police Department, the Orange County Sheriff's Office. And lo and behold, as you get older in life, sometimes God puts things in your lap that shows you that you should say never. And being a member of the Orlando Police Department, I got hired on in February of 1988.
How long did the process take for you to get hired?
Morgan, I graduated college in May of 87. I started the academy in February 7th of 88, I believe, at the J.C. Stone Memorial Police Academy. And so, 6-8 months?
So what'd you do between college and getting hired on, other than applying to every federal agency that wouldn't take you?
Yep, I worked at a sporting goods store, and that was a disaster. Because it just, at that point in time, I had really found what I wanted to do. And I was just as many of us, but I my patience is about as short as a match. And I was really impatient. And I wanted to get started with that because I just envisioned that that's what I was going to, I'd already fallen in love with it before I ever did it.
So did you chase down shoplifters and ne'er-do-wells? Was that, did you try to prepare for the job by doing that?
No, we didn't do it. No, it was a short stint of, you know, probably 4 or 5 months when I got the, you know, the call from OPD that I was hired and going to go to the academy. You know, I think I probably worked up and through Christmas maybe of that year and then took off. And my wife, or she wasn't my wife at the time, but Michelle had, had moved from North Carolina to Florida with me. And you know, we were just trying to get settled in and see where life was going to take us and get prepared for the academy. And so, yeah, it wasn't, I didn't do the sporting goods store thing, but probably, you know, maybe 4 or 5 months.
Just enough to get you into the PD. So how long was your academy, and did you have to stay there? Did you get to go home at night if you were local, anything like that?
I was local. The academy was 16 weeks and it was not a stay at home. Everybody was pretty much local, within a driving distance. We did have some folks that lived out on the coast, but if you know Orlando, that we had some folks from Brevard County, that would drive over, it'd be 40 or 50 miles. But, no, it was 16 weeks, if I remember correctly, 6 a.m. in the morning for 2 hours of PT every day, until, you know, about 5 o'clock every evening. And it was a joint Orlando Police Department, Orange County Sheriff's Office, Academy, but we had others, agencies that would send, recruits to their, to the Academy as well. But it was primarily ran by OPD and OCSO.
How big was your class when you went through? How many people came on with OPD,
if you remember? Gosh, I would say, oh, every bit of the neighborhood of probably 15 to 20. Orange County had probably about the same. And then we had some Winter Park PD guys, some Seminole County. I remember Brevard County. I think there was probably close to 45 or 50.
Okay. Wow. And, but that academy though, since you were combined like that, that's just straight state law enforcement CAD or, you know, curriculum and everything. Cause you learn about OPD after you graduate and you get on the job, right? How they do forms and do stuff like that.
Sure. Yeah. It was all, not eccentric or focused on OPD or Orange County, right? Our two counselors, during that academy were, a sergeant from, the Orlando Police Department and a police officer who were assigned to the academy. But we, our instructors were primarily OPD and OCSO instructors, but we did have others, other law enforcement professionals that would come in and instruct us as well.
So if I were
very,
to go back
very,
go ahead.
Very good at police academy.
So if we were to go back and talk to your counselors, they would say Matt Barton is best known for.
I can fill in those blanks.
Yeah. Matt Barton back then and probably still today is one that is, probably to a fault has spoke his mind. Some people call it speaking their mind and some people call it speaking the truth. So I don't know which one it is.
You are a little bashful, I have to tell you. It's kind of tough to get you come out of your shell.
That's like the job interview. There's this meme going around. They go, well, just, you know, do you have any faults? He goes, yeah, I'm honest. Well, that's not a fault. He goes, I don't care what you think.
You got to love it.
So what was the funnest thing for you about the academy? What did you like to do? What did you excel at?
You know, I was always, I was a Florida redneck from way back. And so I loved the firing, you know, the gun range, the PT. I was always a sports guy growing up, played baseball and football. You know, sitting through long hours of the academy was exciting, but like anything, you know, there were some mundane parts to it. But the police academy overall for 16 weeks was really a cool experience. Probably the biggest thing and the best thing that I did is that prior to the academy, I mentioned my wife, Michelle, is that, we'd planned to get married and, prior to me even knowing we were going to the academy, we planned our wedding date for April 23rd of 1988 in the mountains of North Carolina. So I asked permission, to go and get married. They gave me a half day off on a Friday. I flew from Orlando to Asheville, North Carolina. The worst flight I've ever had in my life, and it was the most turbulent. I mean, truly the picture of people flying out of their seats because there was a late, spring storm over Asheville, and I truly wasn't sure that I was gonna make it. Michelle and I got married Saturday night, had our honeymoon at the Grove Park Inn. One night in Asheville, and was woken up about 1:30 in the morning by Hank Williams Jr., who had a concert that night in Asheville, and his whole entourage apparently were staying on the same floor as we were. and we got up Sunday morning and kissed her mama and daddy and family goodbye and drove back to Orlando, and I was in the police academy Monday morning.
Man, I'm surprised you didn't get a letter from her parents say, hey, no, we need 3 years of experience before you can marry.
Well, her dad used to, people from Florida have gravitated towards the mountains of North Carolina. And we were pleasantly known as Floridiots in the mountains of North Carolina. So I'm sure her dad, probably at the moment, was like, what has my daughter gone and done? So,
hey, I got to tell you, the first law enforcement training I ever went to was actually in Jacksonville. It was what they called the Institute of Police Technology and Management, IPTM.
Yeah, I went to class there.
Yeah. And we went down to the landings, which I think they've torn the landings up since then. And there used to be a Hooters there, which I understand you have some experience with. I'm going to ask you about. But we were sitting there, and the guy starts laughing. I said, what? He said, check out this guy's T-shirt. And on the front, you know you're in Florida. On the front, it said, when I go, I want to go asleep in peaceful, like my grandpa, dot, dot, dot. Then we walked by. The back of the shirt said, not like the other four people screaming in his car.
Hey, let me tell you, having lived here now for a couple of years.
That's true.
there's plenty of idiots to go around.
There's a lot of rednecks in Florida.
I fit in. I'm okay with being a redneck.
Michelle comes from the mountains of North Carolina. When she moved to Orlando with me, she says, I thought that the rednecks in North Carolina, they take the cake in Florida.
Well, it's like I tell Morgan.
We are one. You are one now. You're a transplant.
That's right, bro. That's like I tell Morgan. You can be a leader or you can be a follower in life. In Florida, we choose to be the leader of the rednecks.
And in many of our stories, which I have no doubt Small Town Police Blotter for this episode will contain another Florida guy story. So there will always be Florida man.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, so let's talk about you. You get on Orlando PD. Tell us a little bit, though, about the city. Because the other thing, too, is I used to go to Orlando, actually North Altamont Springs. Used to teach a course there every year for 2 weeks. A bunch of cops would come in, we'd hang out there at the North Orlando Hilton and right there off of I-4 and, have a great time. And like you say, it was funny, those storms every day at 3 o'clock, it just seems like clockwork, boom, storm comes in for a while, moves on. So tell us about Orlando, the county, the size of the police department. Give us a little bit of background because I want to ask you about your work at OPD.
So I started in... of course, the academy was 16 weeks, February to about June 10th, if I remember correctly, and got out. And it's kind of like graduating college, right? You got out and you're like, holy cow, what's in store for us next?
What do I do now? Yeah.
And so graduated on a Friday, started work on Monday and your uniform and all that kind of stuff. And I remember we had about a 2 week, introductory course of this is the Orlando Police Department before we ever went out on FTO or anything like that. And it kind of just went through report writing, what you were going to see, what you were going to do, policies and procedures and all that kind of stuff. And so that was 2 weeks. And then FTO, if I remember correctly, was 13 weeks, I believe. 4 weeks with three different police officers on three different sections of the city. And then one final make or break shooting for your job, 13th week, if I remember correctly. And so back then the police department was 600-ish police officers. Headquarters was right in the middle of downtown Orlando. I would say, Morgan, if I remember correctly, the town, you know, Orlando was, 250, 300,000 people at the time. Big city, you know, Disney, SeaWorld, Universal was coming in, all that kind of stuff. You know, the town was right then at the point in the late 80s of just really blowing up and becoming, you know, not only the great tourist town that it was because of Disney, but with all the other things coming in, it just really blew up as far as the, you know, you would have the people that lived in Orlando, and then there would be just thousands, you know, hundreds of thousands of people there visiting, you know, at the same time. So there was a lot going on in the city at that time.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Well, I got to give you guys credit because I have flown in and out of Orlando many times for a lot of things. And they've got one of the, I mean, they know how to get and move people around, especially in the airport and stuff. It's not always efficient, but that's one of the best places I've been through, you know, in terms of getting to where you need to go. They've got all the transportation set up. You know, Mears Transportation's kind of got the lock on everything. You come out, you can see all the people going to Disney and, you know, hopping on the buses. So when you get out, you make it through your phases, you know, you check out. So how does Orlando divide up their towns? Precincts, districts, zones, how do you guys assign stuff?
At that point in time, there was no district or precincts. Everybody came to work at the police headquarters. At that time was at 100 South UE Avenue. And everybody went to work from there. And so the city was broken into five districts. You had the northeast section, southeast, northwest, southwest, and then you had a central section. And so that was the five districts. And you could get from the headquarters to your area of work relatively quick. You know, they didn't have any of us coming on or getting off right there at peak rush hour times. My first job was after finishing FTO was in the southeast sector of Orlando. And probably at the time was one of the more quieter, you know.
I was about to say, every city, when you divide it up, like when I was a cop too, everybody knows there's always one district we used to call Bunny Land. It's like nothing happens there. You can't go out and count bunnies, right? And then you've got your other districts where shit hits the fan 365.
Yeah. And so I was in the calmer Bunny Land district of Southeast.
They're just breaking you in. They're getting you warmed up, right?
Yeah. And so, probably within, I don't know, 6 or 8 months of being out on my own, I guess did a good enough job that I was recruited to come over to the central sector of town. And the central sector of town was, you know, the more crime ridden at the time, lot of projects, you know, government housing, things of that nature. And the district was the smallest district in town. It was 7 blocks wide and 12 blocks long.
And you could have walked.
It was 24/7 chaos.
Dang.
You wouldn't have had it any other way.
No. I learned how to be the police in Central and made a lot of lifelong friends during that because it was constant. It was truly constant.
Now, what kind of shifts did you guys work? Were you guys, you know, because a lot of agencies, some of them do 312s, 410s, you know, 5/8s, you know, and then did you work, did you have to bid on shifts or were you automatically rotated through the different shifts?
We were rotated. So our day shift was in Central was 5:45 lineup, 6 a.m. on the streets. Shift ended at 2 p.m. 5 days a week. Every 2 weeks you would rotate. So if your days off were, say, Monday, Tuesday, the next week it'd be Monday, Tuesday. Then the next week it'd move to Tuesday, Wednesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And then every, I don't know how many weeks it was, every couple of months you would get a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, then a Sunday or Saturday, Sunday, Monday. So you'd get a couple of 3 day weekends in there, but it was historically 5/8. I never got to, we didn't bid on shifts. My understanding is they started that after I left patrol. A lot of things have changed in police work nowadays, but back then it was 5/8.
Don't you just love, and the other thing too, now, did you work solid day shift, or did you have to rotate then between day shift, afternoons, you know, and mids?
Yep. I think it was every 6 weeks we rotated, maybe every 8 weeks. I can't remember. And so you would go day shift from 6 to 2, excuse me, afternoon shift 2 to 10, midnight shift was 10 to 6.
And don't you just love it too? When I was on the patrol, they would actually, at that time, we would rotate going in like Saturday night at 6 p.m., get off at 3 a.m., or Friday night, Saturday, 6 p.m. to 3 p.m., because we work 9-hour shifts, Sunday, 4 p.m. to 1. Monday morning, you're in at 9. Tuesday morning, you're in at 7. Wednesday morning, you're in at 5. And it's like, so in the span of 6 days, you go from getting home at that time to almost going, getting up and going to work at that time. And that used to screw with your sleep. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And you work six on, three off, seven on, three off. And you guys got hit with, we got hit. So when that, there was that ruling called Houston versus Garcia versus the city of Houston, but it's when they came out with that Fair Labor Standards Act thing of 171 hours and 28 days. I was on the job when that got handed down, and that screwed with everything.
Yeah. So when you would finish up midnight shift, they had it to where it'd finish up and you would be on a Friday, Saturday, Sunday weekend, but you would be 6 or 8 weeks on midnight shift, right? 10 P to 6 A. And then the following Monday, you would be in at 6 AM. And you just couldn't adjust in 3 days.
Even as a young person, it's hard on your system.
Yeah, it was tough.
I think OPD's up to close to 900 officers now.
Yeah, they are big. Yeah, I mean, back then, you know, I mean, it's funny. You look back and, you know, Steve, you mentioned that you met with Eric Smith, the chief now. You know, you have John Mina, who's the sheriff of Orange County, and all those guys were coming on when I left patrol, and certainly when I left the department. I was there 10 years, but I only did, probably 2 years in patrol before I found my niche that I love the aspect of drug work. And so I did everything I could do, to get into the specialized units on the drug teams and things like that. And I did probably my last 7.5 years or so of work at OPD assigned to 4 different drug units.
So how long were you on OPD?
I was in OPD from, and it'll be an interesting story when we get into my time at DEA, but I was at OPD from February of, I was in the academy really, not until you graduate the academy. So I started OPD officially out of the academy, in June of 1988, and I got the call to go to the DEA Academy in February of 1998. And even Steve's smart enough to do the math that is a few months shy of 10 years.
Hey, don't underestimate Steve's ability to not do math. So
yeah.
Wait, I got to take my socks off. Hold on a second.
Yep. So I was about 5 months shy of my 10 years at OPD. And I know I'm jumping ahead here.
Oh, but no, that's okay, because that's what we want to talk about, because at some point you get into these units because you end up meeting this dude named Murphy.
Yep.
Best thing ever happened. Best day of your life. Well, except for the day you met your wife.
Yep. Yep. So, I left patrol. I went into what was called, at one point in time, it was called the Tactical Patrol Force. And I guess somewhere down the line in the culture of law enforcement in about 1992, TPF got changed because it was kinder, gentler, from tactical patrol force to the uniform drug unit. And so there was 20 of us on two-man teams, and it was probably some of the greatest fun and the greatest cops I'd ever worked with. And it was really fun. It was a pleasure. We did a lot of good work. The city looked to us to conquer and tackle a lot of problems that were in Orlando. Believe it or not, Murph, downtown Orlando used to be quite the mess. That was a great time. Did some really cool things there, but it primarily was in uniform. But we did work informants, and we just dealt a lot with just street level drugs and guns and violence. And, you know, the city would send, the police department would send us out to areas that had, you know, an increase in carjackings, or, you know, during the Christmas time of purse snatches in the parking lots and things like that. So it was not only a uniform drug unit, but it was still the tactical patrol force kind of mentality that we would go out to these areas of town that needed an extra presence of law enforcement.
So what drew you towards drugs? Why drugs? Why not work robberies? Why not work, you know, others? What was it about dope that said, this is what I want to do?
More working in the central sector of town, it was so hard hit that I truly just, you could see firsthand and at the human level of the destruction. And it just was something that I felt that, I went to work every day thinking that, you could go there and make a difference. And that's kind of what, you know, it's crazy nowadays when you think about it, but probably a lot of us, and I'm sure there's a lot of good cops out there that still go in every day to conquer the world. And, you know, I went in every day thinking I could save the place.
Well, you know, it's like the fallacy is a lot of guys, even when I was young, I'm going to change the world. What you realize is I can't change the world, but I can change my little patch of the world here. I mean, I can do something here. Everybody's going through an epidemic of something at that point. So what were the big drug problems hitting Orlando that was causing all of this activity?
Oh, it was crack cocaine, 100%.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it was just, there was nothing else. It was devastating. It was a very hard hit. I'm sure there's no doubt that, there was a lot of places in the country that were plagued by that. And Orlando was no different. And it was just, it was truly devastating to the downtown sector, of Orlando. And, the place that was most prevalent that you would go, if you lived in the city of Orlando, was you would go down to the central sector and buy your crack. And crack cocaine addiction knew no race, no creed, no color, no religion, no sex, no age.
So, in your estimation of all the crime that was going on in central sector, you know, everything from robberies, burglaries, whatever, how much of that do you think was related to drugs?
As you hear people nowadays showing out, you know, all these big numbers and how they come about that, I guess it just pops in your head. I would tell you that the majority of crime in the central sector of Orlando was driven by crack cocaine.
Unfortunately,
it was prostitution. It was burglaries. It was theft. It was petty theft. It was murders. I can't tell you how many murders I saw over a $20 rock of crack cocaine.
You know what? And doesn't that seem like, so, you know, based on your narcotics career, doesn't it seem like the smaller the drug dealer, the more violent they are?
Oh, absolutely. I've seen people, it doesn't matter, white, black,
right.
It didn't matter if you didn't pay your 10 or 20 bucks and you tried to drive off on somebody,
Pop-cat. You
had a good possibility of not making it home.
Yep. It's crazy. I mean, we've taken down people with hundreds and hundreds of kilos of coke, and there's never a weapon involved.
Well, it's like when we talked to Luis Navia. Luis was a guy, one of our episodes, he was popped with 26 tons of cocaine, and he worked with Rascuno and these big dope dealers. And his thing was, I never carried a gun the whole time, man. He's stealing in thousands of kilos, never carried a gun.
Yeah, I guess it's the difference between the business and the, you know, and I mean, just the violent aspect of it. And, it, you know, back then, you know, a wad of money in somebody's pocket might be a couple of thousand dollars, you know, but that was everything in the world to them. That was everything they had, was what was in their pocket. And it just, you know, again, you had, you know, smaller drug dealers that worked for medium drug dealers who worked for big drug dealers. And what they wanted was that, you know, they wanted a bunch of $20 bills.
Yep.
So let's talk about this case that brought you up and introduced you to this man we call Murphy, the man called Murph. That should be a movie or something. We should make a series about you, Murph.
Okay.
You know, one of the things that you did. All right.
I think, wait a minute. Narcos.
Narcos might have been. Yeah, you know, that's a loser thing. That's like so, we're so over Narcos now. Although you keep getting brought out to speak about it. You know, by the way, Pablo's not dead. He apparently isn't dead, because he's alive and well when you consider all the stuff you've been asked to do and all the interviews you've done.
You know, how many documentaries can you do on the same person who died 30 years ago?
Well, here's the thing, Murph. An infinite number. You know why? Because you've got a new crop of people growing up learning about this stuff. So you've always got, you know, new people showing up. So
apparently, I mean, this has turned into a career. So I'm happy with it.
Yeah, we'll talk about your trip to Saudi Arabia too. It's like fly all the way over there, you know, for one hour on a panel.
You know what? There were a lot of Narcos fans over there too. That was surprising.
Well, you know, because it's the death penalty over there.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Severe. Yeah. It's like, it's not, we're going to shoot a needle in your arm. We're going to chop your head off in public.
Yeah. And when you're going into those countries, and I've been into a few where you look on the back of the form, they say, we have the death penalty for, you know, importing drugs. It's like, yep, I can check no on that box. No drugs with me, you know.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So let's talk about it. What brought you up to North Carolina, back to your old stomping grounds, right? At least somewhere near them.
Yeah. So, you know, again, to kind of give you the lay of the land, I left the uniformed drug unit, went into the undercover drug unit at the police department, did about my drug unit stint was about 18 months in the uniformed drug unit. I went to the undercover drug unit for probably about 18 months, got recruited into a task force that's probably one of the longest standing drug task forces in the country. It's called the Metropolitan Bureau of Investigation. And it was out of the Ninth Circuit State Attorney's Office, and it encompassed Orange and Osceola County. And so I did about 18 months there and then applied and got transferred over, you know, assigned to the DEA task force, in November of 1994, and worked some really, really cool cases there. One of them, I'll get up to the part about Steve, but one of those cases was I worked a case on a former collegiate All-American football player who went to the NFL and got injured and came out and came back home and got tied into a pretty big cocaine ring. And I will tell you, if it's all right, I'll just leave their name out of it, because they have done their time, been successful, and I don't want to peel any scabs back on him. He's turned into a very good man, and he's working at the collegiate level in a football program now. And it was truly one of those eye-opening things that, boy, how people can get them into something that they wish they never did. And I truly believe this guy. But anyways, one of the guys we arrested out of that case, and it involved in Orlando, even though we were so close to Miami, and you've heard Stevie talk about hundreds and hundreds of kilos and Kevin Stevens and people like that talking about just the, you know, the boatloads of cocaine that would come into Miami. By the time it made it to Orlando, it'd be 10 and 15 kilos. So, I mean, the most dope I saw ever in my life was during this case. And we knocked off at one time the biggest hit. We got numerous kilos through the course of the investigation, but the biggest hit on a one-time hit was 7 kilos. And long and short of it is we ended up arresting this one guy. He flipped, took me down to Miami to work a case on his source down in Miami, and worked with Group 10 down in Miami, who was our response group to Orlando, and got down there and worked with Kevin Stevens, a guy by the name of Mike Seamus, if you remember Mike, Stevie. And when we went down there, we were picking up 5 kilos, which at the time was not even something that was prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office down in Miami, because it wasn't 500 kilos, it was 5. And I think I was either riding with Kevin Stevens or Mike Seamus, but we did a takedown in a McDonald's parking lot, and the guys ran in their car and head on Kevin Stevens' car, the car that Kevin was in. And anyways, got in a foot chase. I caught this guy, biggest human being I ever arrested in my entire life. When I got close enough to him, when I was chasing him down, I literally took my gun and tapped him on the shoulder while we were in a dead sprint and said, "I'm not going to fight you." And he stopped. I was like, I'm a big guy. I'm 6'4", 240. He was probably 6'8", 350 and running like an elk.
Wow.
And I mean, it was amazing. But anyways, I met Kevin Stevens because I know that you guys have interviewed Kevin. But anyways, through this time of getting to of visiting down there to Miami, at Group 10, I always noticed that there was a picture on the majority of guys' desks.
Of Murph, right? Murph went around putting his picture on everybody's desk, didn't he?
Damn right.
And I couldn't figure out who this guy was that was on a red-tiled rooftop holding this dead guy's head like he had just shot a 12-point buck.
In his red Target shirt, too, no less.
In his red Target shirt with his goofy hat.
Walmart. No, it's Walmart.
Yeah.
And that'll come into play later.
Yeah. And so anyways, they told me that this guy used to be in Group 10 and all this kind of stuff. And this was prior to Steve and I meeting. And I'm sure they probably told me his name at the time. But again, like we started off, Stevie called up, or I don't remember, Steve, if you called or if I called Greensboro, because I found out that our guys were running dope to Greensboro. But somehow or another, we ran into each other, and we also have a mutual friend by the name of Rob Murphy, who's the special agent in charge of the Atlanta Field Division for DEA. And it was actually a case that Rob worked as a member of the Uniform Drug Unit with the Orlando Police Department that he brought to me, that we started working jointly, that had ties to Steve's case and Greensboro. So that's kind of the roadmap of how that whole thing got started. And it's funny, I actually, Rob called me this morning, Steve.
Yeah.
So it's just funny how things work out. But met Steve, had this joint investigation, and again, had absolutely no idea who Steve Murphy was. The picture didn't ring a bell, none of that. And we collaborated on these things. I think me and my partner at the time, Joe Gallagher, who was a Volusia County deputy, who was a TFO, we went to, I know, Greensboro, you guys came down. I don't remember which one was first.
Yeah,
but go ahead.
I was going to say, I think the connection came through, as we're building this case on this Haitian organization, we were looking for some historical aspects as well, to put a historical conspiracy together. And you had some defendants that were locked up in a federal correctional institute, not too far from Orlando.
Yeah, in Jessup,
yep.
I think, or in Georgia, but anyways, not far from Gainesville.
Yeah. So I think that's how it started, and then it just kind of blossomed from there.
Yep. So Stevie brought his the two task force guys down with him, who I'm sure carried him the entire way through the investigation.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. That sounds familiar. Yeah.
We ended up at a Hooters in downtown Orlando.
Woohoo.
Now there's a shock. I'm shocked. All right.
And I don't think I've probably besides maybe in college been kicked out of an institution as such. And we got kicked out of a Hooters.
Well, now hold on a second. Orlando. Hold on. You just can't gloss over stuff. So
four off-duty cops.
You gotta work pretty hard to get kicked out of a Hooters. But let's rewind a little bit and talk about this sexual assault that you were a part of.
That Murph was a part of?
No, you were a part of. Apparently, you were accosted by one of the waitresses after she spilled something in your lap.
Was it me or the other TFO, Murph?
It was JD.
Oh, yeah. It was JD. Oh,
it was JD.
Well, see, I was just looking to see whether or not you would confirm or deny it was you. We, you know, we're trying to eliminate suspects in this investigation.
No, I'm not going to admit to that one. My wife will listen to this one day, and so it was not me. But I do remember the manager after that happened, that the manager came over and said, you guys, JD, and I don't know, maybe they didn't have any, Hooters in Greensboro at the time, but they enjoyed themselves a great deal, and we were politely or impolitely asked to leave.
Yeah, but were you asked to leave? I mean, again, it's a badge of honor. You were asked to leave Hooters. Not, you know, you got to do a lot to get asked to leave. But was it because you guys were really being disruptive, or is it because everybody was like hanging around you guys? Nobody wanted to do any work.
No, it was the latter. They didn't want to do any work, and it was not fighting and fussing and being unruly. We were having too much fun.
Well, and I'll just tell you, so the waitress spilled sauce on JD's pants. JD was single, so there's, you know, I mean, it's okay, and he's a good looking guy.
Now, I don't think it was this accidental or intentional. You think the sauce, as you reflect back now, was that an intentional spill, Murph?
I've never been spilled on in any Hooters I've been in. But
well, Murph, you ever wonder why? I can tell you.
I guess I didn't
look
have
at
JD
the picture
with
on
me.
The website, brother.
But then she, you know, I mean, she's being a good waitress, and she offered to clean JD's up. And JD's a good old boy. He's a good old country boy, and he got a little embarrassed, and that just made it funnier. And then the other waitress just started coming over, and we weren't doing anything improper. We were just having a good evening.
Yeah.
No. I mean, nobody's hitting. We're trying to set JD up because the rest of us were married.
Yeah.
And JD's he was so, you know, I don't want to say innocent, but he wasn't used to
there
that.
There was a lot of beer involved, too.
Yeah. Well, and I will tell you, I have a story probably about the same Hooters. So when I told you I would come down and teach a course, so one of those times I brought my middle son down, and it was his, we wanted to celebrate his birthday. Mm-hmm. And we went in, and I found Hooters used to have those baseball style jerseys. Looked really good, you know, the gray, you know. So I got it, but I also got a special thing. So I've never seen my son blush this much. Not only I said, hey, put it on when he did, about six or seven of the waitresses all came up. They had just put lipstick on. They kissed him all over his face, and I got a picture. For his 16th birthday, here's a 16-year-old going, oh, I've scored, you know?
Was it the Hooters in downtown Orlando?
Yeah, I think it was, yeah. I'm trying to think.
That's the one.
Church Street Station.
Yeah, Murph's picture's still up there. Being trespassed.
Church Street Station. We would
not
go
allowed to return
any of the times to for training purposes now. But that's closed, I hear. Is that closed now?
Probably so. You know, probably
I think
so.
A lot of things got hit with COVID. I mean, there were so many nightlife there just shut down.
Yeah.
Let's just check down on the outdoors internet here.
Well, let's kind of talk a little bit too, because now that we've got the Hooters thing out of the way, but so, you know, you got, at some point you have your 3 years in. Why did you wait longer than that 3 years to apply for the feds again?
Well, so we had a hiring freeze with the government from about 90. Oh, I don't know, Stevie, if you can remember, it was early 90s to 94, 95, the end of 94, beginning of 95. And so when it opened back up, I'd just been to the task force a few months. And all of a sudden, of course, 3 or 4 years of a hiring freeze, the number of federal agents had declined through retirements and all other attrition. And so DEA and other federal agencies, you know, just put on a big push for hiring. And I remember again, as I started out with my love for law enforcement, I truly, at this point in time, with, you know, about seven and a half years on, had found what I wanted to do through the task force. And there was just no other agency that I wanted to work for besides DEA. So I applied. And as I said, it took probably every bit of 2.5-3 years. I could not, DEA has a very, and I'm not saying that others don't, I just can tell you about DEA's, but DEA's hiring process is pretty daggone rigorous. Not only, you know, the process itself, the background investigation, the polygraph, but the medical, the actual physical exam, was tough. And I could not pass the hearing test to save my life.
What?
I failed and failed and failed the hearing test.
What'd you say?
What?
Yeah. And I even, so I started.
Was that one of those things where you had to press the button when you heard the beep, right? What you just got to do is just keep doing it all.
Brother, let me tell you, Morgan, I prescribed to that theory until one time one of the nurses came and knocked on the booth and she says, "You cannot continuously push the button." True story. So I failed and failed and failed. I went to, I don't know how much money my wife and I spent. It was outside of our insurance for the police department because it was like, you cannot continuously go to these ears, nose, and throat specialists. And I went to a doctor who was actually Air Force, retired Air Force in the program at NASA over at Kennedy Space Center in Brevard County, who retired. And he came out, and when he saw the hearing test for DEA, he says, "I want to let you know, this is a harder hearing test than we give astronauts in the space program." Wow. And, you know, but anyways, I finally found somebody who, although I failed, said I could hear the tones that was required. And I don't know. Again, I think I did a good enough job through investigations as a TFO that I had a lot of good people. Mike McManaman was my boss at the time, Steve, and you know Mike very well.
He called me this
Mike
morning.
Mike was a big push. Steve Collins, who was at SOD, Stevie pushed for me. Had a lot of people backing me. Somehow, some way, they got a hold of a gal that y'all have interviewed. Named Michelle Linhart. And miraculously, one day I got a call and they said, "Hey, you're back in the process."
What you're trying to tell me is that you had an opportunity to become an astronaut and you turned it down.
Apparently I did, but there was nothing more that I wanted to be.
Well, don't worry. Murphy's an astronaut too. I don't know if you knew that. He excels at taking up space everywhere he goes.
There you go.
Exactly.
That's it. You got to leave your mark.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, sure, your marks are in your underwear, Murph, but as I digress. No.
So, you know, it was one of those things I never thought was going to happen. But it did.
Did you ever find out what the audio issue was? Was it hereditary? Was it just playing sports without a helmet? You know, what caused it?
No, I think what it came down to is, again, going back to the beginning of being a Florida redneck, I just grew up in a family with guns and friends that we would go out and shoot.
And no air protection.
You know, and no concept whatsoever of an earplug or an ear protection. And I can tell you that many times in my life that I shot a true 357 Magnum revolver, I would hear bells ringing for 3 and 4 days afterwards. And it was just something about that pitch. And, you know, through all these doctors, they literally told me, they said, they could tell from the pitch that I, you know, was so depleted in my hearing. They said, you've shot a lot of guns without a hearing protection. I said, I have. And they said, you'll never get it back. And I haven't.
So do you still get the tinnitus, or some people call it tinnitus?
Right.
Yeah.
Now. Yeah. 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 So anyways, got on, I remember I'm a big hunter, and I remember being out hunting, and I got a, back then, of course, we had pagers, right? I was at the DEA task force, had a pager, got a 202 number, got out of the woods. I called the 202 number, and it was DEA headquarters saying, hey, want to offer you a job, and you need to start the academy February 17th of 1998.
So how much advance notice did you get?
That was probably, Stevie, probably December when I got the call.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I got the call late December, and I literally remember telling the lady, and now remember, this was, we didn't have cell phones. This was me going and finding a payphone to call Washington. And I told the lady, I said, I want the job, but I have to do the smart thing, and I need to call home and ask permission.
Hey, players, that is the end of part one. Part two comes out, as always, on Tuesday. In the meantime, go check us out at Game of Crimes on Twitter, at Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. Also, go check out our website, gameofcrimespodcast.com. We've got a lot more information there, including our book list. Any book written by our guests will be listed there. In the meantime, go check us out also, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. It's where we put a lot more content you won't hear on our regular podcast. We go into a lot more topics, and folks, it is a lot of fun. So go check us out, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. In the meantime, everybody stay safe. We'll see you tomorrow for part two.
Knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.